Welcome and thank you for standing by. For the duration of today's conference, all parties will be in listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of the conference. At that time, you may press star one on your phone to ask a question. I would like to inform all parties that today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Thank you. Gabrielle Zelaya, you may now begin.
Thank you very much, and apologies here for the delay in our start, but let's just go ahead and plow through here. My name is Gabriella Zelaya, and I'm the current Global Education Team Leader for the Commercial Service, the export arm of the International Trade Administration at Commerce. Today, we'll be addressing a number of topics within the first webinar of the U.S. International Education Response and Resilience webinar series. We welcome other suggested topics to address in our next webinar. Before we begin, please note we will have a feedback session at the very end. The operator will provide instructions on how to ask a question. We may also, you may also enter your comments and questions in the chat box throughout the presentation. Joan Collian with the Commercial Service in Westchester, she will be monitoring the questions and the chat box and will respond or prompt the question during the feedback session at the end. If we run out of time during the feedback session, we will address the remaining questions via email. I'd now like to introduce our first speaker, Joan Hartman. Joanne Hartman is the Senior Director of the International Enrollment Management, International Student and Scholar Services at NASA, Association of International Educators. Her department serves as a comprehensive source of knowledge for professionals working with incoming international students and scholars, including recruitment, admissions, intensive English programs, advising and support services. In her capacity, Joanne provides strategic staff leadership for professional development programs and services related to IEMISS. Now turning the presenter role over to Joanne.
Thank you, Gabriella, and thank you to U.S. Commercial Service for inviting NASA to be part of this panel presentation this afternoon. Good afternoon, everyone. I appreciate you taking time out of your definitely very busy lives these days to join this webinar series. First off, I'd like to say on behalf of Dr. Esther Brimmer, NASA's CEO, that we want to reiterate NASA's ongoing commitments to international educators all over, as outlined in our strategic plan. I want to emphasize that given these times of profound disruptions, we continue to diligently advocate for policies that support international education, liaising with our government agency partners, and creating resources and discussions in our spaces for our community. By now, you've also seen the announcement regarding the NASA 2020 eConnection, which is our online program for learning, sharing, and connecting with a goal of bringing our communities together at a time when it's most needed. This opportunity, the eConnection, will provide opportunities to share ideas, engage with your peers, and more importantly, look into the future together. And it will be a live program held over 5 non-consecutive days in May and June. Now, moving ahead, between January 30th, when the World Health Organization first announced that the outbreak of this new novel coronavirus was a global health emergency, they acknowledged that the risk of the virus posed to countries beyond its origins in China and the need for a more coordinated international response, till March 11th, when COVID-19 was declared a global pandemic. We've lived, I feel like, you know, through these surreal challenges that could have spanned many, many lifetimes. As of April 7th, 16 million people in 42 states, D.C. and Puerto Rico, have some sort of stay-at-home order, and in late March, it was reported that over 1.5 billion people globally were urged to stay home. And what you see on your screen, challenges to student and scholar mobility. I don't have to tell you about these challenges, as many, if not all of you, faced and are still facing some of these issues, such as adjusting deadlines, cancellation of study abroad programs, closure of campuses, all of us working from home, economic and financial shortfalls that are facing many of our organizations and institutions ahead. Now, in terms of regulatory changes, we have seen this global pandemic continue. Regulatory limitations pose even greater challenges for students and scholar mobility. To compound this, each day, as you know, we're drinking from the fire hydrant, bringing with new information, updates, policies, and each of us having to absorb and decipher information to do our work effectively in supporting students and scholars and faculty and staff. So some of these regulatory changes include things that are beyond our borders, other countries changing, closing their borders or imposing travel restrictions, reductions in agency services, testing postponed. You'll hear from my colleague Eileen later regarding ETS and their services and how they've pivoted to provide for, you know, the new environment for students. Flights as well impacted on that end. Now, to dive deeper into the regulatory challenges, during this unprecedented time, we've seen closures, reductions in services, as I mentioned earlier, but we've also seen some swift action and flexibility from some agencies in terms of policy guidance. So we're grateful for that. However, there remains still key unresolved regulatory questions and issues. So to that end, to date, NAFTA has sent two letters to the Department of Homeland Security and to the Department of State, including other agency leadership. In these letters, we ask the agencies to address immigration-related COVID-19 concerns within these four major groupings that you see on this slide here. They include protect the immigration status of students, scholars, staff, and faculty, provide flexibility on deadlines, filing windows, reporting requirements, the third being use a one government approach, and the fourth, allocate resources to handle surges that may come post-COVID-19. As an example, would be the Department of State Consular Services if and when we emerge from this pandemic, the surge in handling, you know, visa applications and appointments, for instance. So on our webpage, these two letters are posted within the four broad categories that I've just mentioned are key concrete examples of impact on students and scholars in terms of immigration regulations that you can take a closer look at. I do also, before I move on, want to acknowledge and thank in particular our agency partners, SEVP and the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs, who were very, very quick to address some of the most immediate issues impacting international students and scholars when we started seeing the move to distance education and such. So on to more work with our agency partners on the advocacy end. On our webpage, again, you will find a summary of key funding and authorizing provisions in the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security, or the CARES Act. This economic relief package was signed into law, as you know, on March 27th and may be beneficial to international educators. So please take a look. There are additional economic relief bills that are anticipated as funding needs continue to be significant. NAFTA will continue to seek the necessary support from Congress for all international education and exchange programs and activities. So this page that you see on your screen here is on our website that breaks down in detail some of those relief packages that institutions may be eligible to apply for. So, looking at what's ahead, lots of challenges and different issues that lie ahead for us. as you all know, future forecasts are so unpredictable now. We all want answers. So anyone out there who has a crystal ball, please do share. We've started seeing schools make decisions regarding summer sessions, and fall is very much still up in the air. The downstream effects are real and you know, present somewhat of a vicious cycle at times on the impacts of the pandemic. So I've seen a lot of people report the forecasts of flat or declining study abroad or international student enrollment, shifting from semester programs to shorter embedded programs, re-envisioning internationalization efforts, recruitment efforts, hiring freezes, furloughs, and layoffs, and obviously significant budget cuts. Looking ahead, how do you, as an international educator, see international education emerging from this pandemic? We'd love to hear your thoughts on the chat, and would like to see, you know, some of what you are thinking and planning ahead for fall 2020. In my mind, as we see the continuation of this evolving situation, I see some four broad themes that include the economic part of it, the enrollment, smaller incoming cohorts, for example. Will schools be taking a look at, you know, some of the tuition costs or fee-funded programs? What will the future hold in terms of the economic impacts on enrollment, international student enrollment? The second part piece that I see we will be thinking more about would be the student support, the engagement, and the experience, right? As we look at supporting students and scholars online, faculty and staff online, how will you engage them? How will you support their mental health and well-being? So these are some questions in terms of the second pillar, if you will, in my mind, as I envision what when we come through this pandemic. Academic programs and curriculum. So the definition of distance education and online education, there's a difference. What we are doing currently, I've seen a lot of people comment that it is what we're doing is not real online education per se, right? We've just pivoted to the emergency situation that we're in. Hybrid models of online and in-person education already exist and will continue to exist. Will we see more of this? Will students be asking for more of these as they look to, you know, into the future? And then the other piece, as we continue with our advocacy work, you know, how will we look at enrollment strategies as a whole, state consortia, and Gabriella is going to talk more about some of those opportunities later on. So how do we come from it from an advocacy end in terms of international education? So NAFSA also, just like the U.S. Commercial Service, is looking and working hard to provide resources to support the community. New resources are being offered, and as I mentioned some of that earlier is the e-connection piece. I want to highlight a couple that are upcoming immediately in April and May, aside from the e-connection piece. So the e-connection information is already up on our webpage for additional registration and content details. You can refer to that. So my time is up, but I want to leave you with one parting thought. I really, truly personally believe that international education will emerge differently, but more resolute. We have and will continue to collaboratively work together to promote people-to-people exchange. In this pandemic, do we see an opportunity to work in unity and turn the crisis into an impetus, you know, and to improve on the work we do to support international students and scholar mobility? And I strongly believe that we are a resilient group to be able to do that. So without taking much more time, I will now turn it over to my colleague, Malik.
Thank you, Joanne, for this overview as well. And again, as Joanne mentioned, our next speaker is Malik Sundaram. Mr. Malik Sundaram currently serves as the Associate Vice President for International Enrollment Management and Dean of the Office of Global Services at Northeastern University. In this role, he is developing, establishing, evolving, and managing the global recruitment network, including the recruitment infrastructure, institutional partner networks, and corporate partnerships that drive international enrollments for the university. Malik, you may begin.
Thank you, Gabriella. Good afternoon, everyone. First of all, we would like to thank U.S. Commercial Service for the invitation to join this distinguished panel. As every higher education institution, Northeastern has been handling this pandemic with absolute care to ensure our students, prospects, alumni are served with care and empathy. Northeastern University hosts more than 14,000 international students on campus and preparing to welcome more than 6,000 incoming students for the upcoming fall. We've been hearing from our prospective students and families and carefully preparing to support our learners from around the globe. Some of the things that we've been hearing from our current applicants and prospects are challenges that they are going through when they are ready to apply for their admissions process or ready to make their journey towards their higher education abroad. Some of them include not able to complete their final semesters of their bachelor's degree, things like not able to gain access to their transcripts and how they are going to be able to satisfy the transcript requirements that they have in their admissions process, able to complete their standardized tests. We are very thankful for ETS. Aileen will talk more about the online options that ETS have introduced for GRE as well as TOEFL tests. Embassies closed for visa appointments are some of the challenges that we have been hearing and how institutions would respond to these challenges for students while they are going through their admissions process. We are also seeing impact both from economic and financial that families and students are going through from stock markets going down, exchange rates that have been very vibrant, family income loss due to downturn or loss of employment, employer restrictions with educational benefits, and even demand for reskills with some of the employers. So what we are seeing as a common theme is students are looking for answers, students are looking for guidance from higher educational institutions like us to see what accommodations we would be able to make and what support that we could provide through this pandemic for students to successfully go through their higher education abroad application process as well as matriculate successfully into their degree program as they desire for the upcoming semesters. Many higher educational institutions have come together to put their students first and making sure their students are taken care of, both from a support structure perspective as well as any accommodations that we could extend within statutory and regulatory limits that we could offer to students. When we look at as an institutions, we have been very carefully planning for our accommodations for our current students as well as what we would do towards prospective students, also looking at enrollment strategies and approaches towards our next incoming class. So I will quickly touch base on our current accommodations that we have made for our students on our campus. We do have some uniqueness where we operate more than six campuses between U.S., Canada, and London. So we've been very carefully reviewing each of the countries' regulations and restrictions that have been offered and also closely following the health advisory that's being provided by the local state government and local health authorities. And the first thing we had to move, as many of the participants here, are to move the students from on-campus to off-campus, and also move them from on-campus learning to an online learning. This is an evolution for all of us, both as educators as well as student learners that have gone through this quick transition, and they've been able to cope up with the new learning methodologies and new learning structures. We have also made several accommodations, academic accommodations, both from modality of delivery, curriculum that has been adjusted, and gradings that we have been able to look in and adapt to the learning models. And we are very thankful for ASCVP for the accommodations that they've made and considering considerations provided for their fund students who have to be carefully managing their modalities while they are going through their F1 process. We also are very mindful about student services and communications while we have such distance where students are taking the classes from home and even from their home countries. In some cases, we have centralized and proactively communicating with students and parents. We have centralized communication networks that we have built between our leadership as well as our educational leaders that have been proactively communicating to our students. We have also established a customer service units together with a commitment of 24-hour communication turnaround to all the student communications that have been driven to us to ensure that we are immediately able to answer some of their questions. So those are some of the current student accommodations that we have been able to make. When it comes to prospective students, it's a very different recruitment approach when it comes to enrollment management. While we have been focused on on-ground activities and personal relationships that we could build with students and families abroad, in particular, making sure we give them the assurity and comfort for them to make their leap to come and study abroad. We've been forced to move towards virtual campus tours. We had an open house that was planned on our campus right before we closed down, and we had close to 1,200 participants that were going to arrive at our campus. So we had to quickly move towards creating an online version of that open house, and we had a successful participation of prospective students than ever before on any open houses we had. So we've been very much focused on making sure the communication plan that we have for our prospective students and families between now and the fall term are carefully reviewed and scheduled, both that they're having opportunity here from faculty, academic units, as well as student service units to answer any questions that they might have. Many of the questions, as we all know, are still unanswered, and we are still waiting for to see how the pandemic will evolve. So while we wait, we try to provide as much clarity and information we can provide for our students. And that comes with a unified communication to all our students, so they're not moved between departments or pointed to different departments for different advice. So we are trying to make sure the communication is unified and students are served with care, with being miles away, trying to find information and direction about what their next career or higher education abroad journey is going to look like. We have also made some accommodations in their admissions requirements, knowing that they have been having delays in getting their standardized tests. We have made accommodations to defer their standardized test requirements after the first semester, making it a conditional offer. of admissions to satisfy their standardized test requirements after their first semester of being here and having access to some of the tests that they might not have in their home countries. Exceptions to standardized tests itself, they can also apply through the standard exception process that we have established to waive some of those tests that we require, accept unofficial transcripts, and extend submission of their time frame to submit their unofficial transcript until the end of the first semester, and also waiving final semester transcript requirements on arrival and extending the deadline by a semester. These are some of the accommodations that we have made to make the journey for our fresh incoming students much easier, and also not create the tensions that they need to go through to identify how they're going to solve for these while every institution abroad is going through the pandemic situation as well. While we are serving and hoping for the best to come, we are also preparing for online course offerings as well as semester deferrals for students who might not be able to make it to the campus on time due to delays in getting their visas or securing their travel opportunities to travel abroad to come to our campus. This is a very important period for all of our educators to be together to ensure we come together and serve our students as best as we can. We've been working with educational partners on ground as well as our team that are globally placed to ensure that we support our learners through their journey to our campus when our campus open up for on-ground operations. Thank you, and I will turn it over to Eileen from ETS.
Thank you, Malik. And next, I would like to introduce Eileen Tyson. Eileen is the Executive Director of Global Client Relations at ETS. She is responsible for overseeing communications and outreach for TOEFL and GRE to the more than 11,000 higher education institutions and government agencies in over 150 countries that accept these tests worldwide. Eileen, if you can begin, please.
Thank you, Gabriella. And I'd like to echo my fellow panelists in thanking the Commercial Service for inviting ETS to participate in this webinar, but also to thank them for having this series of webinars. I think we're all trying to understand this new environment, try to understand it, and know how to respond to it. So these seminars help us all with our thinking. So thank you for that. Testing is a critical element of higher education to help institutions have confidence that the students that they admit are prepared, that they're ready to succeed in their courses. ETS, with its more than 70 years of pioneering research and assessment for higher education, has the gold standard tests that are needed for higher education. But during this crisis, how could we get those tests to students so they could continue their academic journey? Clearly, reliable and secure innovation while still maintaining quality was urgently needed while test centers around the world were closed. So our innovation, our solution, was to offer tests at home while test centers are closed. So what are the at-home tests? They are the tests that you already know and that are already used and trusted as part of the admission process. They're the same research-based, valid, reliable tests. The TOEFL IBT test measures English proficiency. We do that by measuring all four skills. We use what we call integrated test questions, and we also have 100% academic content, so that the kind of English that your applicants are going to be using in the classroom, that's the kind of English that we're measuring, not general English. We're also talking today about the GRE general test, which is a measure of graduate readiness. And we evaluate that readiness through three measures, verbal reasoning, quantitative reasoning, and analytical writing. So the at-home tests are identical in content, so we're measuring exactly the same thing, identical in length, format, and even the on-screen experience that test takers see in a test center, they're going to see in the at-home tests. We at ETS will be using the same scoring criteria, the same scoring process, and the score scale, so that scores can be accepted and used in the same way. Although at-home testing is resulting in us incurring additional costs, we're offering the tests at home at the same price as testing in a test center. It's a really hard time for everyone, and that includes our students as well. So, and finally, the scores are delivered to universities in the same format that they currently receive them. So no change. No change in format, content, score delivery, and scoring. So if all of that is different, it is the same, what is different? And what is different is the test delivery method. So instead of testing in a test center, students will test in their homes. The test sessions are going to be monitored through a combination of live human proctors and artificial intelligence technology. The entire test session will be videotaped, and we'll be using this at-home testing until test centers reopen and the situation returns to normality, which I know we all hope will be very, very soon. So ETS began slowly. We offered it initially in just 9 countries to make sure that the testing went well, to make sure it was successful. Having seen that the testing meets our high requirements, we then opened it up to the rest of the world. So currently, wherever the GRE general test or the TOEFL IBT test were offered on computer, in all of those countries, the tests are available for at-home use, with just 2 exceptions. The exceptions are mainland China and Iran. In mainland China, we're working closely with the National Education Examinations Authority to accommodate the test takers who have been impacted by these test cancellations, and that will include measures such as adding test dates once we're able to test again. In Iran, we're working to offer at-home testing as soon as possible. So what are the eligibility requirements? Our requirements are listed on our websites and at the end of this presentation and in the slides that you will have received already. You can see the URLs for the student side of the at-home testing and information that's designed especially for universities. The requirements are not onerous. The testing at home requires a desktop or a laptop computer. The test needs to be taken on with a Windows system, or it can be taken on a Mac computer if Windows is installed on that Mac computer. It's also necessary to have a camera in order to show the proctor the environment to do a 360-degree scan of the environment. And for security reasons, we do not allow headphones or earbuds, that kind of thing, during the testing. Now, the room also needs to meet requirements for to be a suitable requirement. And one of the important ones is that it needs to be in a private place. It needs to be in a quiet place where other individuals will not be coming into the room. So one of the questions we receive, one of the most common questions we receive, is whether accommodations are available. ETS has always been concerned to offer accommodations to those who need them, those who have disabilities or health-related needs. Now, the accommodations that are available for the at-home test are extended time, extra breaks, screen magnification, selectable colors. And then there are other accommodations that can be requested through ETS's disability services. But let's move to the question that most people have when they first hear about at-home testing. Frankly, I'll be honest, I had the same questions. So it was important to me that I would get good answers to my questions. So as I mentioned earlier, we're using a combination of two types of approaches. We're using human proctors that are there while the testing is taking place, unlike, you know, another remote testing possibility. Unlike them, we have our test, our proctors present during the test, all throughout the test. And the benefit of that is that the human proctors can be watching all during the test. If there's anything that's going wrong in terms of the test taker having difficulty, or if there's something going on that shouldn't, they can be aware of it, and they can stop the testing at any point. And then we're using artificial intelligence technology. Now, there is a wealth of information that we are able to glean from artificial intelligence technology. Whenever we talk about security, we talk about the many things that we do for our tests, but we always hold some information back, and that's because we have to, in order to not have test takers know and then find ways around them. So I'm just going to mention a few of the AI technology things that they can catch, but please know that there are many other pieces of information that we are gathering during the testing. So the AI technology would include facial recognition, gaze tracking, and as I said, the video recording of the entire session. Together, they will help to support security. So by some other examples of test taker activities that AI will flag include attempts to open a new browser during the test, to run unpermitted software, and to use unpermitted objects such as a cell phone. Now, note taking is part of both of our tests, so it's still allowed if a test taker would like to do that. However, the notes can only be taken on a whiteboard with an erasable marker that the test taker must erase at the end of the test. They must show the proctor it has been erased. Or they can bring in a piece of paper inside a transparent sheet protector. They can write on that sheet protector and then erase it after the session is over. So let me just refer you to this this slide. It has lots of information for you, lots of resources for you. there's information on how to reach us. We're doing a series of webinars. We have 5 more coming up. We encourage you to join the webinars and reach out to us. We're happy to answer any questions you have. Thank you very much. And I will turn this over to Gabriella.
Thank you very much, Eileen. So I will be presenting just a little bit about the commercial service and programs that we have offered on the virtual technology side. Okay, great. So the U.S. Commercial Service, we have a network of about 118 offices across 75 countries and have education specialists in 100 cities in the United States and a total of 1,250 trade specialists on staff. Our mission is to promote the export of U.S. goods and services, and we work with federal agencies, associations, consortia, and other partners to support this effort. And our clients are intensive English programs, private high schools and boarding schools, academies, community colleges, four-year colleges, universities, graduate programs, education service providers, and education product and technology providers. So within the Department of Commerce's International Trade Administration is a global education team composed of trade specialists with education industry expertise that work closely with the U.S.-based educational institutions and education companies to assist with and offer customized programs and services abroad to foster education service exports. Our virtual education fairs, or VEFs, have become a hallmark service provided by the global education team. And with these programs, we use WebEx technology and invite up to 6 U.S. schools to present for up to 10 minutes each on their school programs to recruitment agents viewing the presentations overseas. Part of the program includes, of course, a welcome kit with updated education market information, a welcome letter from the commercial office or at the post, and profiles with contact information for participating recruitment partners. And here you see the upcoming programs that we have specifically for these upcoming months. And there is a cost to participate in these virtual education fairs. So you can see for India, we've set a cost of $750 for participating education institutions. So new as well is something that we have prepared specifically for this time, and it is our educator-to-educator virtual connection program. We have typically provided the educator-to-educator program during the NAFSA annual conference, but in this case, we are taking it virtual. So we are using the Aventia online platform, and we're inviting U.S. education institutions and city-state consortia to register and request one-on-one meetings with agents, counselors, and university partners overseas, and these would be virtual meetings. So this is an opportunity for U.S. institutions to promote their programs and for study states to highlight their states as study destinations. Meetings are planned to take place the week of June 8th through 12th and run from 4 a.m. to 11 p.m. Eastern Time, and of course schedules will vary based on your own schedule that you select. You can also block off times that you won't be available. Registered U.S. participants will receive the contact details of all international contacts that register for the program, and we will also offer showtime meetings, which are our counseling sessions with U.S. Commercial Service education specialists from several overseas markets, and they can advise on market selection, education policy, landscape, and provide an understanding of foreign students' preferences. And the fee to participate in that program is set at $250 per registrant. So if you would like to register, we've included the link. And if you have questions, we've got our trade specialist in charge of that program on this slide. So we just recently also launched the Global Education Education and Training Services Guide for 2020. And in this guide, we have up to 57 individual market assessments listed as best prospects for U.S. training and education services. Assessments are based on the observations and market research of our trade specialists, and you can access the individual market assessments by visiting our website, which I've included in the last slide here. So here is the website where you can find this information. If you want the actual guide as a PDF copy, you can connect with your local commercial service office and they can provide that to you. But it's trade.gov/education-industry. And we have been invited to speak on NASA's Government Connection, recruiting virtually with the commercial service. So you will be able to learn more about our virtual programs and other programs that we are offering during this time. That webinar will take place on Wednesday, May 6th at 2:30 p.m. Eastern, and we'll provide, again, more information during that webinar as well. So with that, I'd like to pass the presentation over to our colleague from the Small Business Administration, Jeff Dees. Jeff Dees is an export finance loan officer with the U.S. Small Business Administration, a position he has held since 2011. He is one of 21 such SBA loan officers in the nation who provide export finance assistance as part of their suite of services available from the Multi-Agency U.S. Export Assistance Centers, or USEACs. After working 2 years in Portland, Oregon, Jeff opened SBA San Francisco, California Export Office in late 2013. He works with exporters and commercial lenders in Northern and Central California to find export financing solutions for small businesses. He also serves as the team leader for all of SBA's export finance officers in the Western U.S. Jeff, do we have you on the line?
I think so. Can you hear me?
Yes, Jeff. Please begin your presentation.
Okay. Wonderful. Thank you very much. And I know you're going to advance the slides for me, so I appreciate that. So thanks, everyone, for being on the call. I work for Small Business Administration, a federal government agency that finances both domestic and companies that sell internationally that are in the small business category. That includes education businesses. So let's go on to the first slide here. And that will show you what, in normal times, would be the definition of a small business under SBA rules. You can see that for the education industry, we have a size table that has all the different types of business categories. For the education industry, typically small business is defined by the annual revenue of the company. But I want to talk to you entirely today about something that I normally don't talk about, but unfortunately have to when we're all thinking about, which is the disruption caused by the COVID virus and the availability of some disaster loan programs that businesses can benefit from. And the good news is that the standard definition, yes, it does apply if you qualify under it, but there are a lot of other portals for approval as well. There's a lot more generosity in determining whether you're a small business eligible for disaster loan assistance beyond this. But if you're within those standards, if you're annual revenue is less than that level based on the type of education services you provide, you're definitely eligible. And then each of the programs have a slightly different permission, and I'll go into that. But I wanted to put this up there first so you know sort of where you stand. If you're good here, you're good throughout. So let's go on to the next slide. Now, there's really a pre-existing SBA disaster loan program. Whenever there's a hurricane or a flood or a wildfire or whatever it may be across the country, obviously lots of homes are damaged, businesses are damaged, and SBA actually plays a big role in coming in and providing disaster assistance loans to homeowners and to businesses. We have a standing program called the Economic Injury Disaster Loan Program that's been deployed. It was the first one out of the chute to respond to businesses whose operations have been disrupted by the coronavirus. And the way it's, I'll talk about that, but that's a program that has been around for many, many years, and never on this scale has it been deployed where it's a nationwide emergency, but that's one that's been around for a while and is on some level well known, though some new things have been added to it. And then just, two and a half weeks ago or so, the CARES Act, the $2 trillion stimulus act, was passed by Congress. And that added two new disaster loan programs that SBA was asked to be participants in. One was a supplement to the Economic Injury Disaster Loan Program that existed before, an advance, and $10 billion was allocated for providing advances under that loan program. I'll talk about that in a minute. And then an even bigger program, the Paycheck Protection Program, with $349 billion allocated to it, was created. And so we've been very frantically working on delivering both of these programs, plus the other program, to businesses that are eligible across the country. And the key resource here, sba.gov/coronavirus, has links to all of these programs and everything I'm going to talk about. But let's go on and talk a little bit in some detail about what programs are available to help education businesses in the U.S. So let's go to the next slide, and I'll talk first about this Economic Injury Disaster Loan Program, or EIDL, as we call it. EIDL is not a great name for a disaster response program. It sounds pretty lazy, but it's a great program, and now it has an advance. So if it was EIDL before, it has an advance. So let's take a look at what that consists of. So the EIDL program, it is a direct loan from Small Business Administration, my agency, to education businesses in this case, for revenues lost, for gross profit losses caused by the disruption of whatever disaster it is. So we would look at, what do you normally make in your historical performance, say per month, and then based on that, we would say, wow, you know, the coronavirus has prevented education from happening as expected. You've lost cash flow. You've lost that revenue for some period of time. Don't know what period of time SBA is using, but we'll multiply that by, let's say, 2 months. Then we'll say, okay, you know, if you were normally making $200,000 a month and now you're not making anything, two times $200,000, that's $400,000 loan. Up to $2 million is the maximum under this program would be available. And this loan is then made available to the business to recover, to keep itself intact until the disaster is over. And there is a provision to go back. Wow, what if the disaster lasted longer than that? There's a provision to go back for increases in the program. And it's here's the loan then, an amount determined by SBA based on what you've told us your typical revenue is. You use it to recover. But, hey, you haven't recovered yet. You're still in a disaster. How are you going to pay this thing back? It is a loan. The repayment is set at a pretty low interest rate, 3.75% interest. Or if you're a nonprofit, it's 2.75% interest. And then the good news is the first payment will be due for 12 months, so hopefully the disaster is over before then. And then we structure with really lenient terms up to 30 years repayment. So you've got plenty of time to recover. The payments will not be that intense. A lot of the standard program requirements about collateral and personal guarantees, and do you have the ability with your internal resources to cover your costs, a lot of those have been waived and loosened substantially. So we encourage nobody to be to withhold from applying based on what they fear might happen. Let's wait and see what the terms actually end up being. There's been a lot of innovation to try and get these loans into the hands of businesses that have been suffering. So then on to the next slide, you'll see the new feature that was added to this. So we would offer this loan, but as you can tell, there's some underwriting that goes into it, some thinking and human intervention, not artificial intelligence, real intelligence, hopefully that's good, coming up with a loan amount. So while you're there, you need some help right away. So the idea of the advance is we can quickly see based on your application, hey, you're eligible. We just don't know how much you're going to get. We can advance up to $10,000 to your business to at least keep the lights on or whatever it may be, and then that will then be deducted from whatever loan you get. But also the good news is that advance would be forgiven. It would just be like, okay, you know, don't worry about it. It took us a while to get to you. Take $10,000, and it's actually not necessarily always $10,000. It's up to $10,000. The way it seems to be operating at this point is basically $1,000 per employee. So if you add 5 employees in your firm, then that would be $5,000, not $10,000. If you have 50 employees in your firm, they would be $10,000. So that's how the advance works. It essentially gets you some money quickly when you apply. So let's go into the next slide of what educational institutions qualify for this program. And so did we go to the next slide, Gabrielle? There you go. Okay, so yes, all of the for-profit businesses that meet the SBA size standard are eligible. And then if you're a nonprofit, including faith-based organizations are now included in this, so religious school of some kind or something. You can, regardless of size, we're not concerned about size, if you're a nonprofit, you can qualify for this program and apply. So if you're one of those categories, how do you apply? Let's take a look at the next slide. There's an online application. If you're in one of the businesses, many businesses have been applying for this. If you applied before March 30th, that's when we got a very stable platform. Before this, we were just getting bombarded with applications. And so we really needed to have everybody reapply starting March 30th if they had applied previous to that. If you have applied at March 30th or later, you're in. I know a lot of people are wondering, where's my loan? Where's my advance? It's coming. You're there. You're real. You're in. And so just be patient, stand firm, and endure. If you really want to find any additional questions about this, and there's no application fees on this. If you want to find out the status of your application, have other questions, there's a contact number there for you, as well as a website that you can dig into that in more detail. So that's the first program. Let's take a look at the second program. That is the Paycheck Protection Program. So next slide. Beautiful title slide, and then let's go right into the program features. Okay, this is the $349 billion program that Congress created with the Stimulus Act 2.5 weeks ago, and it is not a loan from Small Business Administration. No, this is a loan you would go to your bank and say, hey, I want to get one of those Paycheck Protection Program loans. It's a forgivable loan. It's structured this way. You would provide them with an application and evidence of what your payroll is in a typical month. So we look at last year's typical payroll divided by 12, multiply the typical payroll times 2.5, up to a maximum of $10 million. There's an upper cap per employee. So if you have employees that are making more than $100,000, you can't apply for that overage above $100,000 per employee. You get a loan for whatever that amount may be. So let's say your typical payroll is $100,000 a month. That would be a $250,000 loan you would get from your local bank. And it would say, here's the loan. What can you use it for? You can only use it for four things: to retain your staff, to pay your payroll. You can also use it to pay your rent on your business facilities. You can use it to pay interest on your business facilities. And you can use it to pay your utilities on your business facilities. Nothing else. You're not allowed to do anything else with this. So that's where the EIDL loan can be helpful. You can use that for your accounts payable, supplies, whatever it may be. And with this loan, there's no collateral requirement. There's no personal guarantees. And there's no means test, regardless of the wealthiness of your principals and your how much you have in your bank account. This is designed to put some money in your hands from via your bank that you're going to use to keep your staff employed so they don't get laid off because of the cash flow crisis you might be experiencing. And then you lose your staff, they go off and find a better job, or another job, or they aren't available to come back, and you've got to, once the crisis is over, your workforce is disrupted, you want to keep them on your payroll. So if you do that, you're really helping. If you get this loan, you help your business employees. You're really helping the entire United States. This loan is going to be forgiven, provided you get at least, it's going to be forgiven based on, let's go to the next slide. If you take the money and after 8 weeks you come back to your lender and you show them that you spent 75% of this loan, at least, if not more, to pay for your payroll, and you use not more than 25% for all those other things, for rent, mortgage, interest, and utilities. And if you only used it for those things and you used it at least in those proportions or more for payroll, then your loan will be forgiven. If you used less than 75% of your loan for payroll and use more, say let's use your rent and your mortgage, interest, and your utilities, you say you spent 30% of the loan for that, well, that extra 5% that you didn't use on your payroll and you used in excess of 25% on your non-payroll expenses, that you would have to pay back. You would pay it back you've got a deferral of 6 months from the time the loan was first made to you, and you'd have to start making payments after that first 6 months. The interest rate would be 1%, and it would all be due and payable in 2 years. So not an extremely onerous payment, but you would have to pay that back. Also, if you got an idle advance, that could be counted against what was forgiven on this, and you might have to pay it back that way. Okay, so what education institutions can get this program? Well, let's take a look at the next slide. And you'll see there lots of ways for educational institutions, way more than under the IDLE program. So first of all, the original table that we started this thing with, but also we have a number of employees standard. And here we're counting those as not FTEs and figuring, you know, out. But if you're a for-profit and you have not more than 500 employees whose primary residence is in the United States, because we're wanting to provide payroll for those employees, you can qualify. And if you're a for-profit, if you don't meet that standard, well, if you're a for-profit and your average two-year net income is less than $2 million and your net worth is less than or equal to $15 million, you're in. You can use the program. Or if you're a nonprofit with not more than 500 employees whose primary residence is in the United States, you're in. And if you're a faith-based organization under that definition of a nonprofit, then you're in. And, of course, you have to have been in operation this year to qualify for this as of February 15th. So a lot more educational institutions. Now, you'll notice on both of these, none of the, you know, government entities are not eligible for this. So if you're a state university or something, that's not going to qualify. But if you're a nonprofit, yes, you do. 501c3, excuse me. Okay, next slide. How do you apply for this one? Well, it's simple. There's a two-page application, and you go to your bank, and they will more than likely have it online for you to fill out there. You provide them with documentation of your typical monthly payroll. The best place to go, so you've got to go to a lender. What lenders are making these loans? Well, you know, my advice is you've got to go pretty much to the bank that you do your normal business banking with. They know who you are. It'll be much faster to do it that way. I know not every bank is accepting all of the clients that are bombarding them for this, but if you go to try and open a new business banking account somewhere else, you'll find it takes quite a while to get a banking relationship set up, and you won't really probably be able to get that done very quickly. It'll delay the process. There is a link that SBA provides of all the eligible lenders that can offer PPP. They're eligible, but they're not required to, so that's perhaps a conundrum, but we're adding more lenders all the time. In fact, we just added a bunch of fintech lenders, PayPal, Square, Intuit, OnDeck, some others. And so anyway, all that is on that website, and those fintech lenders are very excited to deliver things quickly under this program. So I mentioned there was $350 billion allocated by Congress for this. Well, as of yesterday, this is where things were at. Over a million PPP loans have been approved so far. So just in the basically not even 2 weeks, really about a week and a half that this program has been there. It's been moving very, very quickly. And in fact, I was just on a teleconference just before this or as this call was happening, and we've now passed the $300 billion level. So there won't be too much more time before all this money is committed. The good news for education businesses is you're pretty well represented in the group of businesses that have been getting these. There's 15,000 PPP loans to education businesses, $5.6 billion. That's almost 3% of the loans are going to the education sector. You know, when the money runs out, I don't think it's a question of if, but when. My sense is from reading the newspaper or reading the news online, there's a lot of interest in refunding this program, maybe addressing some of the issues that might disqualify people unintentionally, and getting more money into the hands of people. So stay tuned for PPP 2.0 as it is presented by Congress and the President in the coming days. And then finally, let me just give you this contact slide resources. Again, there's the website, local resources. SBA has district offices all over the country. The best place to get information is from your local district office or your small business development centers and other resource partners. You can find them all at that local assistance / find website. And that's me too. I'm happy to get calls, and I normally do export financing, but it's all hands on deck to deliver these disaster programs. So thank you, and I appreciate the time, Gabriella, for presenting this important information.
Thank you very much, Jeff. And this brings us to the feedback session. I know we have a number of questions in the Q&A chat box, and several were sent to me as well as a host. I know we have Joan Conlian helping us with the Q&A, and I do apologize in advance. We have run out beyond the hour, so if you can still hang in there with us, we will try and address as many questions as we can. The questions that we do not address currently, we will go ahead and address via email as well. Joan, do you have any questions that you would like us to address from the Q&A box?
I think I've been trying to address them as they come in. I do know that we have another partner of ours, IELTS, that mentioned that they are offering online English language tests as well. So I want to share that with the group. Do we have time for the operator to take any? I know that there are instructions.
Sure. Let's have the operator give instructions on how to ask a question.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. You will be prompted to record your first and your last name. Please unmute your phone before recording your name.
We have received a couple of questions regarding visa resumptions, and that is, as you all know, an issue for the Department of State, and we will may be able to address that on a future one. I don't think that fits within the purview of our speakers today, but I absolutely agree that that's a shared concern of everybody in terms of when the embassies will reopen and be able to process us again. At that point, that's not known to us. We would certainly share that if we have the information, but I did want to acknowledge that I know that's a question that many people have had.
Great, okay. Do we have any questions in queue?
I am showing no questions.
Okay.
We will be sending out an audio recording of this, right, Gabriella, afterwards, so people can...
Absolutely, an audio recording, as well as several folks have asked for the PowerPoint presentation that was sent out with the reminder email. But if you have not received that, we will be sending this out again with the recording. There was a couple questions for SBA. Jeff, one person was wondering if you actually approve these loans, if SBA is approving these loans.
So the EIDL loans, the economic injury loans, those are approved by SBA. I don't personally work in that department, but there are people assigned to doing that. And then the PPP loans, those are actually approved by the bank. And SBA is providing a loan guarantee. That's basically fully delegated to them. So as soon as the bank approves it, it's approved.
Great. Okay. We do have a question for ETS, for Eileen. Can you please confirm the total fee for the at-home test? The website does not make this info readily available. Eileen?
Yes. The cost of the test is the same as it is if it were taken at a test center. The cost varies by country. We try to be very price sensitive in certain countries. The worldwide average, I would say, for the TOEFL test is $207. That's a worldwide average.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Please. No, go ahead. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Eileen. So we have another question here regarding virtual technology being used to showcase campuses. So the programs that I spoke about with the commercial service and the virtual programs, that is using the WebEx technology and also Eventia, the Eventia online platform. We are not currently using the VR or virtual reality technology, if that's the question, but those two are online. Basically, those two technologies. Let's see here. I'm just scheduling through. One of the questions was about the CARES Act. What is the CARES Act? Is Jeff, can you provide kind of a brief definition?
Oh, sure. Yes. The CARES Act is the Coronavirus Assistance Relief Emergency. I don't know. It stands for something, but that's the $2 trillion stimulus act that was passed by Congress, signed by the President on March 27th, to address many things related to the disruption of the economy and put more, you know, people to work in the hospitals and elsewhere to respond to the coronavirus. And part of that was assistance for small businesses.
Okay, great. So there's a follow-up question. It says, for the EIDL, will I still get funding if I apply now for the EIDL?
Yes, I would say everyone should apply that thinks that they have suffered a cash flow disruption, let us take a look at it and see if we can improve something for you. But, yes, I think the application portal remains open. And I think the deadline to apply is something like December or something like that. So there's no, your urgency is what dictates how quickly you apply. But, yes, we're still accepting applications.
Okay, great. So I know we have a few more questions in the box here, but we are 20 minutes over the hour. And so I do want to be respectful of folks' time. So with that, I would like to thank all of our speakers today and thank all of the education representatives that have joined the webinar. As we mentioned, a recording will be made available, and we will send it right after this webinar. If you have any additional questions, please do send those to us by email. So please stay safe and stay healthy. And operator, can you please end the recording?
Yes, thank you. Thank you for your participation. You may disconnect at this time.